Listening Dog Media.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
The Offside Rule. Promoting women's football since 2013.
Our guest on The Offside Rule this week is Carrie Dunn, who's written many books on women's football. She is a doctor as well. A doctor's in the house, Tash. Carrie, we want to talk to you specifically. I know there's so many areas that you could talk to us about, but specifically about Wales. Now, you live there at the moment, and you've been working with Aberystwyth Women, I believe. So I'm trying to get an understanding of what the league situation is like over there. Is it thriving?
It is thriving. It's a very confusing place to be, I think, in terms of women's football, because if we cast our minds back kind of 13 years to the start of the WSL in England, that's a bit what it's like in Wales now. They're kind of still testing out things. No one is fully pro over here in the Adrian Prem. There's this push towards semi-professionalisation. But if you look at the genera Adrian Premier League, you'll see the top three teams. You've got Cardiff City, you've got Swansea City, and you've got Wrexham. Now, they're all fully semi-pro teams, but I think we can, the obvious thing to draw from that, you've got three men's clubs supporting those three women's teams. None of them play in England, and that they all play in England, so they don't play in Wales. They are not teams that are based in Wales, so they're getting money from the English leagues and then supporting the women's teams. So the teams that play fully in Wales, their men's teams play in Wales, which is also a semi-professional league, the men's league. It's very tricky. It's a really challenging time. And I think a lot of the ideas that the FAW are putting into practice are possibly the right ones. But, you know, as always, Linz, I have this, I'm always a little bit cautious when the plan is rely on a men's club to fund your women's team, because women's teams end up getting pushed down the priority list.
How far off do you think then the league is from maybe going fully pro? Do you think that's a possibility within the next, you know, 5 to 10 years? Or do you think potentially it's never going to reach that level?
I mean, I think the women's leagues have more chance of turning fully pro than the men's do, to be honest, because they're smaller. And with, you know, Cardiff, Swansea and Wrexham kind of setting the pace, I think other clubs will kind of want to keep up. But I don't see it happening anytime soon. It's just too difficult. I mean, there are not the facilities here. There is not the kind of, you have the grassroots investment and you have the interest from the community, but the women's game is still not quite there. And obviously, with Wilkinson being appointed as the Wales manager, I think maybe that will start to change from the top. Maybe there's going to be some more investment in that. But yeah, I wouldn't say it's going to happen anytime soon.
Yes, speaking of the national team, because this all has a knock-on effect. And when we were talking about setting up this interview, you brought to my attention that there's only one of the senior Wales internationals that plays in Wales currently. All of the others play in England or abroad. So Would you say that it's having a knock-on effect for the national team selection? And is that in a detrimental way, or have you just got to accept that for Wales internationals, they're going to have to play their trade abroad or in England?
Yeah, it's sad, actually. I mean, you look at the junior setups, and you've got so many of them still playing in academies at the age of kind of 17, 18. Well, okay. But then, as I mentioned to you before, you've got Emmy Starfield, who's the Aberystwyth, who's plays for Aberystwyth Town. And she's in the under-19s, but she's the only one of that age group playing in a domestic league. You think, well, you know, there should be some kind of effort to keep that talent in Wales. Again, we saw this in England 15 years ago. You had this massive talent drain because these young girls were not getting the chance to play a decent level of football, and they were going to America. They were going, you know, overseas to Europe and spending their school holidays out playing in Scandinavia or whatever. So, you know, I think Wales can learn something from some of the errors that England made in those early years. But in terms of the senior setup, yeah, I mean, you can understand why. I mean, if you can't play fully pro in your domestic league, then, you know, you are going to move abroad. And that probably is what you want your senior internationals to do. But in terms of the junior age groups, I really do think that perhaps there are some conflicting priorities. I completely understand that they want the girls' academies to thrive. And I understand that maybe in some situations they might want to say, you know, go to England, go to one of the academies where you can train full time, and, you know, maybe you'll get a step through to the WSL. But it does make me a little bit sad that the domestic league isn't clearly not being thought of in high enough esteem, that they want to encourage that kind of that progression through the domestic league and have your best Welsh players thriving at the top level.
Is this all a bit of a flashback for you, Tash, to your time when you were starting?
Yeah, I think as well, the way the game's going now in England more so, because I think the opportunity maybe to play for myself when I was first breaking into women's football, we didn't have underage groups, you know, so I was playing first team football at 14 at Watford. And then I feel like the opportunity was there a lot more. Whereas I feel like now for your younger English talent, it's harder now with all the internationals coming over to the WSL, all the top talent. So I think it's more challenging now for young players to play. And I think it's really interesting, Carrie, listening to you. My partner, Becky, she's a scout for the Welsh national team. So I see day in, day out, the challenge of actually trying to find more players in the pool, you know, because truthfully, let's be told, probably the Welsh senior squad has picked itself for the last 10 years at least. So I think it's great now to see younger faces get embedded in. But I do worry slightly because you do have that group of players that have been there for so long. It reminds me of like the Australian national team. They've come through for so long together. What happens when those players, your Jess Fishlocks, you know, you could name quite a few, your Ingalls, your Haz James, you know, there's a good handful of them end up retiring. Is there that pool of players, that pool of players that can come through and take their place? I think that's the big challenge now for Wales. And it's something that I know they're working really hard on. But like you said, if the younger players aren't getting that opportunity, you know, will they then be ready to take that step up? So it's tough. But I hope the people at the top, like you said, are really invested and at least trying to do the right things.
Yeah, it's interesting what you're saying about the senior squad, because when the most recent senior squad was announced, you have got some of the under-19s coming in, but they're not attached to clubs. They're still academy players. That is going to be a heck of a step up. And these are very talented players. You know, I've seen them play, but it is a step up from academy football to playing against women, isn't it? That is a big jump. So it's great to see them getting the chances. But again, as I was saying, this is something that we've seen in England when the start of WSL. There was this idea we wanted to improve the national team and we wanted to make sure that there wasn't this talent drain of young players going overseas. And sometimes perhaps they're conflicting. Maybe you can't have both all the time. Maybe one has to be prioritised over the other. And I think maybe that's a little bit what Wales are seeing now.
We've got that experience between the three of us. I mean, Tash, from a playing perspective, we've observed, Carrie, the evolution of the WSL. So what can we learn from that? You know, if you're going to take that to Wales now and say that that's where they are and they've got this journey ahead, sometimes you don't want to replicate everything. You know, are there some things that you would want to not change?
Yeah, as you know, Linz, I'm always very cautious about some of the big changes that the WSL have brought in, because I do feel in some situations things have been changed and pushed on very quickly without really having time to fully evaluate what went well, what didn't go quite so well. And I do feel in some ways that Wales are doing some of the same things because they're seeing Cardiff and Swansea and Wrexham push towards a semi-pro model. You know, the likelihood is, I think, probably one of those teams might turn fully pro in the next few years because they have plenty of money and the interest is there. But you have to then ask, what about everyone else? Do you really want to have a breakaway of three? Do you want to have a competitive league? Again, something else that WSL was really worried about back in 2011. I didn't want to have the breakaways. I wanted to share talent around. I wanted to make sure that people winning the trophies was getting shared around a bit more to make it a better spectacle. No one wants to, well, apart from Cardiff fans, no one wants to watch Cardiff win every single match every single week by three clear goals. They want to see a decent competitive league. So it's really difficult. And I think what I would like to see Wales learn from is perhaps slowing down some of that push towards urging these women's teams further on. Try and close that gap a little bit more, you know, offer a little bit more support to some of these women's clubs who, you know, on the pitch, you know, they are close to these other clubs, to these breakaway big three. But off the pitch, they're not. I mean, is there some kind of structural support that can be offered? I think that would be what I'd want Wales to learn from some of England's mistakes.
And for both of you, let's talk about the commercialisation when it comes to the national team, because the Lionesses' success saw loads of deals come in. And some of these players are now earning great money away from football because of the commercial deals that they're getting. But one of the big complaints, and I know this has happened from a Wales perspective, Scotland and Northern Ireland as well, is that they're not getting those same deals, you know, when it comes to boot deals or it comes to people wanting to stump up to support the national side. It's like the Lionesses are in a different league. Are you finding that there's a commercial problem? And I know, Tash, for you, living with Becky as well, she'll probably be on the case with this all the time.
Yeah, I think with that, success helps. And it sounds awful to say, but, you know, the Lionesses winning the Euros, the Lionesses becoming household names has allowed them to then get those kind of deals. I think as well, the growth of the WSL has allowed superstars to be able to grow their brand. You know, don't be deceived. There's still WSL players at top clubs that still have to pay for their boots. You know, I know half of the Liverpool team don't have boot sponsors still. So I think, yeah, it's great for some people, but a lot of it is, unfortunately. I don't think it should be the case. It should be, you know, how big is your brand? How big is your following on your social media? You know, you could have won nothing in your career, but if you've got, you know, 100 plus thousand on Instagram, you're getting deals, you're getting paid, whereas you maybe got someone that's potentially won Champions League football, but maybe isn't as big on the social media, that's still having to pay for their boots. So I think then that's even a bigger challenge then for the Welsh national team, because maybe not playing in major tournaments, that doesn't give them then really, except for your Jess Fishlocks. Yes, there are names that are growing in the Welsh national team, but there isn't massively household names with regards to, yes, let's sponsor them. What can they give us? I think that's always the thing. Brands are thinking, what can they give us? What can we get from them? And they probably don't see that enough, really, with regards to that.
And I think the Lionesses have created this illusion that women's football has made it and all female footballers are pro and making a great amount of money. I know when I've been doing stuff at Aberystwyth, you know, on a match day, so I'm supposed to be the media officer, I'm running around on match day, I'm doing the gate, I'm selling raffle tickets, I'm trying to get someone in to sponsor the match ball for 50 quid a pop, and I've got to get them into the lounge, and I'm getting the kettle full and make sure there's tea bags and fresh milk in there, and I'm doing all of these things, and people saying, we want this, we want that, we've paid to be here, which is, you know, absolutely right. But you're kind of like, I'm a volunteer. This club is run by volunteers. This league is basically run by volunteers. And that's still the case pretty much in a lot of championship clubs still in England. And so the commercialisation of very, very top level of the women's game is brilliant. And I'm so glad that women are making great money from what they're good at now. But it doesn't trickle down necessarily. And I think that illusion about that the Lionesses has created is a very deceptive one.
Mm. Lindsay, you obviously know Carrie a bit better than me, but can I ask you, Carrie, what actually got you into women's football in the first place and writing? And, you know, yeah, I guess I want to know why is it your passion? Did you play or, what's the story?
I played a little bit when I was a kid. So I grew up in Bedfordshire, actually, Tash. And the funny thing is, I remember watching you play for England, maybe 12 years ago with my dad. And I remember saying to him, when we were watching Ian and Bob play 20 years ago, I never thought we were watching the next generation play for England. And I never thought it would be a woman. So there you go. But yes, I grew up watching.
Cool story.
I know, right? So I grew up watching Luton and St Albans and, you know, I grew up in Bedfordshire, Hertfordshire area. But the argument I always make is that I was part of a generational glitch in the late 80s and early 90s when women's football was shown on Channel 4. The FA Cup final was shown. There were highlights from tournaments as well. So I grew up watching Marianne Spacey and Jill Coulthard and Kaz Walker on television. Yeah, fantastic players. So I always knew women's football existed, and it always makes me really sad to hear players now in their 30s or late 20s saying they didn't know, because I guess I was really fortunate that I knew it existed. So I never thought that football wasn't a space for me. But obviously the media coverage was slightly lacking. So
see, that's our divide, Carrie. You know, I didn't get to see those highlights. I didn't get to watch it. I was just very fortunate. And I think this is when it's a bit of a postcode lottery that my PE teacher played for Wolverhampton Wanderers Women. So she started a women's team when we were about 15, 16. And my next door neighbour, two doors up, was the Wolves women captain. So I knew women playing football, and she used to watch me in my garden, and she used to encourage me to play more. But it was one of those where I could have completely passed, it could have passed me by, I think. It's just one of those lucky things that you end up going, oh, this does exist. But yeah, very interesting that it was being shown and those highlights. I didn't realise at that point that you got to watch it on TV, because I felt like that I'd only just come. We'd only just started doing that.
I know. Again, it's one of the things that I was bang on about the history. I think it's really important that we don't forget this. You know, this was happening in the late 80s. This was a big thing. And, you know, the fact that I think it's actually almost a bigger thing that it didn't happen during the 90s than the 2000s. You know, it's one thing to say we haven't had it before the past 5 years. It's quite another to say we did have this in the 80s and 90s, and then it stopped happening. So I guess that was perhaps also one of the other reasons that pushed me to write about women's football, because I became a sports writer, found myself in an office usually full of men. And again, this is, I wrote for lots of very big newspapers when I first became a sports writer, and there was not scorn necessarily, but an absolute lack of interest in women's sport and women's football in particular. And I remember having the 2005 Euros on in the office and me being like, I really think they should be covering this because it's literally in this country. And there's this idea, you know, no one's going to read that. So from 2005 onwards, I guess it's been, I get that. That's kind of been the driving force, I guess. So some of the kind of little comments that you had, you know, throughout your childhood about girls shouldn't play football and all the nonsense you get from people who don't know what they're talking about, and then become a professional writer and then still getting some of these comments even then. So yeah, it's kind of amazing to think in the past 20 years things are different now, but there's still a long way to go.
Speaking of which, you wrote an entire book about the missing lionesses. Now, there is a film coming out, Copper 71. I understand that you're taking a lot of the Aberystwyth women along to watch this film. You wrote about this, Carrie. I think it's really important that you could give us a bit of a preview to this film that's coming out in cinemas, because you know it so well.
Oh, do you know what? When I saw that this film had been green lit, I WhatsApped all these women from the Lost Lionesses squad. I'm like, are you going to know Serena Williams? I'm like, yes, we're so excited. So to see this actually coming to cinemas now is brilliant. But these women, the fact that their story is finally being told, and it's being told on the big screen, it's just amazing. I mean, I always tell that kind of a 5 minute summary to students just to kind of shock them a little bit. But this is an unofficial Women's World Cup happening in 1971. A guy called Harry Batt, who coached a team called Chiltern Valley in the Women's FA League at the time, was asked whether he would bring a British representative team. Now, couldn't call it England because the FA had very strong control over that, but they were called England and all the media stuff over in Mexico. And he put his squad together, but who's going to go over and take 6 weeks off from their work in the summer of 1971. These female footballers, they're not going to get sabbaticals, they're not going to get paid leave. It's very difficult to try and put a squad together. So Harry Bett thought, well, who can I get? And it was primarily a load of schoolgirls made out of that squad. So you had 13, 14, 15-year-old girls going out, playing for this representative side over in Mexico. This is my favourite bit. So Harry Bett and his wife June went to these girls' houses, talked to the parents and said, yeah, this is what we're doing, here's the itinerary, here's how we'll be looking after them. And these girls flew out to Mexico with the squad to play football in front of 100,000 people in the Azteca. Now, of course, this is the time before you could ring home very easily. Of course, you couldn't email. And so, you know, they sent a couple of postcards, I think. But otherwise, they were away from their mum and dad for all that time. And what happened? Because they played in front of all these people, they came back, and this was an unofficial World Cup. It hadn't been sanctioned. And these players were punished. The young girls were banned for kind of between 3 and 6 months. The older ones were banned for slightly longer. Harry Bett was banned for life. He never coached in the women's game again and passed away in the 80s. But also, really sadly, these girls didn't really talk about it again. Because they'd come back and they'd been punished. They kind of felt like they'd done something wrong because that's how they were being treated. So they didn't even talk about it to each other. And so in the past kind of 4 or 5 years, they have started to talk about it and share some of those memories. And it's just fantastic that it's being chronicled and that we've got this documentary and these women are still here to tell their stories. Because I think that's one of the things I've talked to you about before, Lindsay. It makes me so sad that we've lost so much women's football history because nobody talked about it. And we're so fortunate that we have so many of these trailblazing women of the 60s and 70s still with us now. So the fact that they're here to tell us what happened, share their stories, is just amazing.
So when's this happening? I want to come and watch this.
Is that next weekend?
Okay, nice. Mm. Right, that'll have to be in my diary.
Yeah, and
so yeah, we're all going next Saturday to the cinema in my local village. Who I emailed and said, "Can you please show this for us? I should bring a load of footballers with me." So yeah, we're very excited.
And when you did your book, Carrie, how did you find out about that story? Because if no one spoke about it, how was it on your radar?
There are documentation of it, and there are pictures, and there are some film clips, but this is kind of one of those, I guess it's one of those women's football myths that gets passed down through the ages. But what, again, this comes back to being a Bedfordshire girl. Women's football in Bedfordshire in the late 60s, early 70s was a massive hotbed, I think partly because it was quite a big factory place. So just like during the First World War, and you had all those factory teams, the same thing was happening in the 60s and 70s. Women were taking breaks from work and they were playing football in the yard. So you had a load of factory teams in Luton and the wider Bedfordshire area. So Chiltern Valley, they were based in the Bedfordshire area. Luton Daytels, you know. And a lot of these lost lionesses are still in the Luton and wider Bedfordshire area. So, yeah, I kind of knew they existed.
Have a little catch up. Catch up together in Harpenden. Let's get together.
Brilliant. It's a hotbed. Brilliant. We started off on Wales. We've ended up with Bedfordshire. Carrie Dunn, it's a pleasure speaking to you always. We could go on and on. But are you hopeful about the future for Welsh football then? And when you're looking at the role that you're playing, this voluntary role, are you hopeful for the next few years? We'll end on this.
I like to think that I'm hopeful, but I'm also realistic. I think women's football always has additional challenges that men's football doesn't necessarily face. When I was going around pre-season trying to get in sponsorship money for the women's bank account, you would get loads of businesses saying, well, we've already sponsored the club. And they haven't sponsored the women, they sponsored the men, but they think that, you know, the men is the club. And it's not. We operate independently. So I think we always have bigger challenges. You know, men always have priority on facilities. Men always have the prime TV slots, you know, all that kind of thing. It's just the ongoing battle that we always have to face. So I am optimistic, but I'm not unrealistic about the challenges.
Sounds like you might have a lot of material for another book, though, at least. thank you very much, Carrie, for your time.
Thank you.
The Offside Rule. This is a Listening Dog Media production.
Sports
Social Podcast Network.